And it is my intention now to add a little more to the towards the idea of building stellar systems. And as I think you may have noticed, both the book and my lecture series start from fairly general principles, that is to say, just plain equations of motion in classical mechanics, build on those in a general way, discussing things like potentials and conservation laws, and that we have more or less done by now. The next step is to consider stellar orbits, that is to say, the behavior of individual particles in a given potential, with the ultimate goal, of course, towards constructing an entire stellar system, be it a globular cluster or a galaxy or anything else of that sort, from those orbits, and thereby to try and solve the self-consistency problem that we had been discussing fairly frequently until now. Now, I also already indicated that this self-consistency problem, in a sense, is insoluble in a pure gravitational system. The reason for this being, of course, that the pure gravitational system only has attractive forces and therefore, of necessity, can never, ever possibly be in equilibrium. So the question then before us is rather different, and that is, if we can solve this self-consistency problem between having a collection of stellar orbits that together generate the potential in which everybody moves, can we perhaps identify what you might call a pseudo-equilibrium there, something that may not really be a solution to a non-existent self-consistency problem, but something that at least can live for a long time. And with a long time in this case, of course, is meant a time with an order of magnitude, with a size that is many orders of magnitude bigger than the characteristic orbital timescale for the stars in question. Now, if you think about this for a moment, you might object that this should be relatively easy. Look, for instance, at our solar system. That is, by and large, a self-gravitating system, and that has lasted for the better part of 10 billion years, or 5 billion years, or something thereabouts. I mean, the age of our solar system is 4.6 billion years, and that is 4.6 times 10 to the 9 times the characteristic timescale of our solar system. You think that's enough powers of 10 to call something like that stable. Now, the key difference here, of course, resides in the fact that our solar system is dominated by the Sun, which is 1,000 times more massive than all the rest of the solar system together. And in a stellar system, we do not have such a situation because of the Eddington limit, which is that a star blows itself up by its own radiation when it has a mass bigger than approximately 120 solar masses or something thereabouts. It cannot be that a stellar system has a central dominant mass. Well, you might object again. We know by now from observations that most large stellar systems, such as our own galaxy, have black holes in their centers, and would they not provide the stability, in a sense, that our Sun imparts on our solar system? And the answer is no, because they're just simply too small. It may, for our human understanding, be a little bit big to say that you have something like a 10 million solar mass black hole in the center of a galaxy. But from the point of view of a galaxy, which has 10 to the 11 solar masses or something thereabouts, this is totally negligible. This has absolutely zero importance for the stability of the system as a whole, except in a very, very, very long time scale, something of the order of 10 to the 60 years. Therefore, we might consider doing things precisely the other way around. Now, that is saying, would it not be interesting to see what happens if we started with a stellar system where all the stars are equal, all have the same mass and things like that? And for the moment, this is the tack we are going to take. We're going to look at the individual stars. And as you know from gravity, the acceleration of gravity is independent of mass. And therefore, if you consider individual stellar orbits, the mass of the individual star is insignificant. It's just simply, if you were to take a pineapple and you put it in the same orbit as the Sun, it would have precisely the same orbital properties. It is only later that we will come back to this, that we will have to reconsider the mass distribution of the stars in stellar systems. And then it will turn out, for simply equipartition reasons that are easy to comprehend, that the most massive stars in stellar systems will have a tendency to aggregate in the center, and the rest will sort of be on the periphery. There again, for a very large stellar system, such as our galaxy with its 10 to the 11 stars or something thereabouts, this is not really an effect of very great importance. But for smaller stellar systems, such as globular clusters, and in particular large open clusters, this is certainly of importance. Now, in this lecture series, we will not really be emphasizing small stellar systems, such as open clusters, very much, for the relatively straightforward reason that there, numerical techniques have by and large overtaken the analytic techniques that we are discussing here. As you'll see in the book, and with all its 800-odd pages, it is mostly algebra. It is mostly analytic approximations and things like that. But if you have something of the order of 10,000 stars in an open cluster, you can, by and large, dynamically solve that entire system on something that is not much more complicated than your desktop computer. So, with that in mind, let us go back to where we had left off before and start to consider the properties of stellar orbits. And let me recapitulate a little bit what we've been doing so far since we skipped last week. We had already, by and large, dealt with Chapter 2 in the book, that is, the potential theory and the behavior of simple potentials. I had also talked with you a little bit about numerical methods and recommended a Professor Portugis-Swart's lecture series in this respect, and it is now approximately time to start and look a little bit more at the orbits. Now, I will do this starting then at Chapter 3, the initial paragraphs of which I commend to your attention, but I will not treat them explicitly in these lectures. So I'd rather start with Section 323 on page 164 of the book, because that gives a very good insight into what the characteristic timescales are and what the characteristic, shall we say, physical properties are of what the physical properties are of a stellar orbit in a stellar system. We will see there that the mass being insignificant, as already mentioned, in gravity, the acceleration is independent of mass. The most relevant quantity is a timescale. Either you might call an orbital timescale or a timescale that represents a deviation from that orbit. And it is the timescale of the deviation that we will consider in the following little bit. What we'll do is effectively the following. Let us, for the moment, simplify the whole system to a cylindrically symmetric system, or a spherical system, which is, of course, the same, a little bit more specialized. And we ask ourselves what the characteristics of an orbit in such a system would be. Well, you might say that is very simple. The maximum energy orbit would be something that is a circular orbit. And the question that you can then ask yourself is, how realistic is this? We know from the observations of our own galaxy and external galaxies that the circular orbit, interestingly enough, for most of the galaxy is not really a very bad approximation. And the reason for this is at first incomprehensible. Why would a stellar system take it into its head to have mostly circular orbits? If, for instance, you look at a globular cluster, a large concentration like this, and orbits can have all sorts of bizarre forms. And certainly, and that again, I will try and demonstrate in the computer someday, you can see in detail is not really composed of circular orbits. Why would the galaxy do that? Well, the answer to this is relatively straightforward. It is the same answer as you would have in the case of our solar system. All the planets move in the same direction in the same plane, not because they decided to do so, because they were formed from a gas cloud. And this is almost certainly the case also in the case of a galaxy. If we look on this thing on the side, then mostly you'd have a system that looks something like that, and it could not possibly have had that form except if it already started like that in the beginning. So it bears the sign of its initial conditions. Now, of course, there are other systems that do not do this. They're all more spherical galaxies. We'll get to talk about those in a moment. If you follow the motion of an individual object in a cylindrically symmetric potential, then effectively there are only two potentials where all the orbits are closed, and those are the ones where the potential is either proportional to the radius or proportional to 1 over the radius, and this of course is the case of our solar system. By the way, just from a didactical point of view, I have an urgent request of you people. Now, this is something that you may want to think about when you're otherwise bored. Why is this? Can one easily explain why this is so? You can explain on the back of an envelope basically all of Kepler's laws in our solar system, with the exception of one, namely that the orbits are closed. I have never, as long as I've been thinking about this, being able to come up with a fairly straightforward argument that you can tell your friends in the bar why it is that orbits in this type of potential are closed. So please, if you know the answer, please tell me. That being so, what we can do is ask ourselves what is going to happen if we have a slight deviation from these circular orbits. And I'm just copying from the book, so don't bother to take any notes on this. We start on page 164, 323. What we ask ourselves is, what would a small deviation from this orbit look like? If we were to write down the equations of motion, not for the orbit itself, but for the deviation from a circular orbit, what is it that we're going to get? And the answer is the following. You can write the potential that you have as an effective potential, which is the potential which you will get at the radius of this circle over here, which they call R sub G in the book. All right. the second coordinate, of course, is the azimuthal coordinate, right? So you have a coordinate system where you have radius and azimuth over here. Of course, that's obvious. And then if you go a little step out, or a little step in, or a little step forward, or a little step back in that potential, and you can ask what you get. Well, if you go forward and back, you get no difference because we had presumed that the system is cylindrically symmetric. Then is there another degree of freedom, which is up and down, which for practical purposes is not perhaps so very interesting, but which I'm going to also take into account. Now, what you will get then is several extra terms, 1/2 times the second radial derivative of the potential, all right, times x squared, and the x term, of course, disappears because you're locally in equilibrium, plus you have 1/2, okay, times the second phi dz squared, okay, times, I should call capital Z over here, sorry for that. Oh, by the way, that's interesting. They don't write capital Z in the book. Well, good for them. Terms directly proportional to Z, the vertical height above the plane of the galaxy, are zero, and the reason that this is so, that we have presumed that the galaxy is mirror symmetric, you know, with one side to the other. And we decide to leave all the rest out. So just simply take the first approximation to the way in which this potential changes when we go a little bit further out or a little bit further up and down. If you put this in the equations of motion, you will realize immediately that because the equations of motion go with the first spatial derivative of the potential, that it is these two terms here that will give you effectively the equation of a harmonic oscillator. And the reason for this is straightforward. The first derivative of x squared is x, right? So if you go a little bit further out, in this orbit, you will find yourself under the influence of a restoring force that goes back in this direction, which is directly proportional to the displacement. And similarly, when you have a vertical displacement like this. And therefore, the deviation of this motion from this circle here is composed effectively of two oscillations. One oscillation radially and one oscillation vertically in this direction. Now, you may want to ask, is there anything else in a azimuthal direction? So the question then becomes, if I were to displace a star in this direction, over in this direction over here, will the motion just simply go like this? You have a what is called a guiding center, which is the motion, the unperturbed motion of the circle over here, plus an oscillation in this direction. And this oscillation, we already know, is going to take place because of this quantity over here, just simply there by construction. So what's going to happen? Is this star just going to rock back and forth with respect to this guiding center, or is it going to do something else? Well, you may recall that in one of the previous lectures, I had already mentioned that gravity is a bizarre thing. If you want to overtake someone in orbit, and if you are in the same orbit, you've got to step on the brake rather than the accelerator. And the reason for this is that in our solar system, we call this Kepler's third law, that orbits inside go faster than orbits outside. And therefore, it is to be expected that if this small deviation from the guiding center here goes outward, that the star will lag behind in its orbit, only later to be picked up on this side to go run forward with respect to the guiding center, and so on and so forth. So, effectively, the motion that we expect has only one physical quantity associated with it, namely the oscillation frequency in the radial direction, and of course, similarly, the oscillation frequency in the vertical direction, plus this, what you might call Kepler's third law, which means that when you go out, you lag behind, and when you go in, you race forward. So this is basically the orbital motion that you would expect. So effectively, you would have a oscillatory rotating motion like this while the guiding center proceeds around the periphery over here. If you were to ask yourself, how is this for the vertical oscillation? And this is, of course, different. Because in the vertical direction, we do not have such a thing as Kepler's third law. So, vertically speaking, if I were to draw the cross-section of this orbit over here and over here, vertically speaking, you just simply have an oscillation that would do this. Now, whether or not it has this exact shape with many of these wiggles or not is something I want to leave undecided for the moment. That usually depends on the potential in question. But you get my drift. It turns out, by the way, that in practice, the oscillatory frequency in both cases is not too very different, not too very different from the orbital frequency. And that means then that you get something that is looks a little more like this. So, as I mentioned, the corresponding oscillatory frequencies here and here are not too very different from the orbital frequency. And that is to say that rather than having orbits that, if you just look at the vertical case, looks like something like this, they look more like that, a sort of slow, what they call Lissajous figure in old classical laboratory physics. Now then, let us see what these frequencies would be. And the reason I want to emphasize this is that many of the properties of galaxies you can understand by thinking back to these characteristic physical quantities, the orbital time scale or the orbital frequency, if you will, and these two frequencies, the vertical and radial deviation frequency. Obviously, those frequencies are related to the derivatives of the potential over here. And let me write them down over here. If you get this, of course, the two here would be incorporated in the one half when you do the derivative. So it's just simply this second term here that is of importance. And therefore, this quantity over here is what's important. So the second radial derivative of the potential has gotten a name, and that is kappa squared. And kappa is known as the epicyclic frequency. And obviously, you have something similar over here. The second vertical derivative is called nu squared, and it doesn't have a separate name, I don't think. You can call this the vertical frequency or the up and down frequency, or whatever you want to call it. Why is it then that we can immediately say that these frequencies, in particular the epicyclic frequency, are not expected to be very different from the azimuthal frequency? Well, you will realize that the azimuthal frequency comes from this quantity over here, and that's already present here and there. And consequently, you would expect that numerically speaking, they would not be very different. There is something else as well, which goes into this, and that is because the characteristic solution of Poisson's equation, which we had seen before, the characteristic solution of this, which is 0, is 1 over r. That means that the potential can never have sharp edges. If I construct a potential out of individual points, every single one of those points will contribute a little bit, 1 over r, to the overall function. And 1 over r is an extremely slowly varying function without a characteristic length scale. Right? It's a power law, and power laws don't have any characteristic sizes. And therefore, you would expect that there are never, ever going to be very, very steep gradients in a potential, right? Consequently, these quantities over here and their original function are going to be comparable in numerical size. I'll get to that a little bit more quantitatively in just a moment, but this is something that we can readily expect. Now, what does that mean if we were to ask ourselves what the overall orbit of such a star is going to be? Vertically, you had already seen what's going on, right? I already sketched this over here, so let me put this back again on this quantity over here. So you would have something that oscillates relatively slowly. So this is a realistic estimate of what the orbit of a star would be when you look edge-on onto a cylindrically symmetric stellar system. Over here, you would expect that if you start a star a little bit further out, it would get something like this. All right. Why do I draw it in this particular way? Well, that is sort of understandable when you think again about what I just said a moment ago about Poisson's law and the behavior of the potential. In a spherically symmetric system, we had already seen previously, the effective acceleration is determined instantaneously only by that amount of matter which is inside the radius of the orbit. That is to say, if I were to take a star on its orbit over here and I follow it inside the orbit of the guiding center, it would effectively be accelerated a wee bit less than the orbit over there. And therefore, it would get a shallower radius, a shallower curvature, a bigger radius of curvature. When you go out, the opposite is the case. And that is why the orbit doesn't typically close and has the so-called rosette form. This is not what it might have been, namely a sort of very ferocious oscillation with respect to this guiding center over here. There are exceptions to this in very special galaxies, and we will encounter one a little bit later, that is, barred spiral galaxies do have, under certain circumstances, rather different behavior, but we'll get to talk about that later. Well then, the physics point of view that this impresses on us is that a galaxy can be thought of as a collection of gravitational oscillators. And those oscillators have a number of characteristic frequencies. Of course, there is the cylindrical frequency, right? The orbital frequency of the circular orbit, the epicyclic frequency, and then the vertical oscillation frequency over here. You might think that this is sort of like an interesting exercise to do in the back of an envelope, but doesn't really have very much more to say. However, I do hope that from your previous experience in physics, you realize that the system of oscillators can be physically very active. That is to say, it can, for instance, have resonances, right? You may well ask yourself, and I hope that you have immediately, in the meantime, asked yourself this question. Is it possible, for instance, for any of these frequencies to be a rational multiple of the orbital frequency? In which case you get what in classical physics would be called a resonance. And those resonances, as I think you are aware, have very great influence on the way a system evolves. Well then, let us investigate this. The limits that one might place are the following. I'm sorry. You have the epicyclic frequency. You have the omega, all right, the angular frequency of the unperturbed circular orbit, and you have this vertical frequency over here. For the moment, let us concentrate on those in the plane of the orbit over here. Let us ask ourselves if we can put any limits on this. And the answer is yes, we can. If you were to look at what happens for a potential that has a 1 over R type behavior, in other words, if we were to concentrate all the mass of the galaxy in the center, precisely over here, or I say in the center, but at least inside the total orbit of the star, right? Then you get a situation where you have the closed elliptical classical Keplerian orbit. And that, of course, means that in that case, you have that omega equals kappa. Another thing you might do is say, well, let us do precisely the opposite. I take all the stars in the galaxy, I smear them out homogeneously in space. In that case, you get another situation. You get that kappa equals 2 omega, and I commend this to your attention, and you simply put the corresponding potential in here. Which means that in a realistic case, which is somewhere in between, you will have a situation where you have something like this, right? And that is the numerical expression of what I said just a moment earlier, that epicyclic frequency is by and large of the same order of magnitude as the angular frequency of a circular orbit in the galaxy. Now then, omega doesn't exactly equal kappa, because that would mean that all the mass of the galaxy is in the center, and kappa doesn't exactly equal 2 omega, because that would mean that we have a homogeneous distribution of stars, which by and large isn't the case either. The question then you can ask yourself is, what other relationship could there be between the epicyclic frequency and the angular frequency? Now, the interesting thing is that you instantly will realize that if this is a rational multiple, k and m are integers, that in that case the orbits are closed. And these then would be what we call resonant orbits, right? If something happens to a star, no matter what it is, it will happen again a certain amount of time later. In this particular case, k times m times 1/2 times the orbital timescale, right? So after several loops, this whole system closes on itself, all right? The resonances in question, of course, as I think you realize from most of the classical literature that you know in classical mechanics, those resonances are most important where this is a rational combination of small integers, you know, 1 over 2 or 2 over 3 or something of that general sort, right? Because that means that after only a relatively small number of galactic years, does the orbit close on itself, right? So you can get a sort of cloverleaf orbit of this type. And there again, this means that if you are on such an orbit and something happens to this galaxy, then it will happen again and again and again in exactly the same way on resonant orbits. And that is why their response in general in a mechanical system is rather stronger than just any arbitrary quantity. I'm not going to expand on the vertical motion of a star like this because, in a sense, it is less interesting, right? jumping forward now to what we had already said previously about the motion of the epicycle, we can skip to page 169, which effectively is a version of this diagram over here. And if ever you want to remember, you want to give yourself a hint as to why it is that the oscillation on the what you call epicycle over here is retrograde with respect to the orbital prograde motion, all you have to remember is that outside orbits by Kepler's third law are slower than inside orbits. Right? You immediately get the idea. In the book, it is shown that, algebraically, it is shown that in the case of the Keplerian potential, that is to say this one over here, the one over R potential, the actual ratio of this particular small ellipse is exactly 1 to 2. Right? So it is a nice ellipse with actual ratio of 1 to 2, which, of course, means immediately that the orbit is closed. Right? Now, this is something that you can show algebraically in very many ways, as this way, for instance, also. But just waving your hands, this is a little bit more difficult. Well, then. If one were to think of a galaxy as composed of this type of orbits, one may ask oneself, how useful is this going to be? For an ordinary cylindrical galaxy, which is cylindrically symmetric, this is perhaps not so very interesting, although one of the things that is remarkable is that this whole idea of a stellar orbit being effectively a three-dimensional oscillator, right, is going to remain. I commend to your attention what is written a little bit further on page 174. If you were to look at page 174 of the book, figure 3.10, you can see that these orbits really do look very much like very nice three-dimensional oscillators, even in the case where the potential is no longer cylindrically or spherically symmetric. Right? It does help in understanding what galaxies do, and a case in point is when the galaxy itself is not perfectly cylindrically symmetric, but has a small deviation from that. And that is the next case I want to treat with this and then leave it for something else. Suppose that rather than having a stellar distribution which in the mean all the stars compose is cylindrically symmetric, let us think of one where the mean distribution is slightly flattened elliptical distribution. So this would be looking down on the galaxy, and in the plane of the galaxy, it can basically have any flattened form of this general sort, right? Now then, there are several things one can ask. One is, can a system like this with a definite flattening exist just simply stationary in space? An interesting question to ask yourself. Or would it have to rotate? Now, of course, one's daily experience with ordinary stuff that you have in and around the house, the garden, and whatever, would almost of necessity mean that this will have to rotate. A stationary elliptical thing of this sort immediately sort of suggests an outside force. It is possible to make a sausage, but then the sausage has a skin around it, right? And similar things for a banana and all that good stuff. When, however, the whole system is made up of stars, each of which is more or less living on an equal footing with respect to everybody else, the situation is different. And, of course, one would naturally think that this would have to rotate in one direction or another. This is not necessary. All right. We do have stellar systems which are flattened in one direction, which can perfectly well survive with this orientation in space. However, frequently this is not so. There are many galaxies that have a central stellar distribution that is flattened in one direction, that does in fact tumble end over end. There again, we have to think back to why this would be. I already mentioned to you earlier when we were talking about flattened stellar systems like this, where the stars by and large go in, not necessarily circular, but at least very restrained orbits like this. That would almost certainly be due to the same fact as that our planets in our solar system are all rotating in the same direction. The reason, of course, is that it formed from a gas cloud that collapsed, and that from that gas cloud, objects condensed and then started to remain more or less in the orbit in which they were formed when the system was still gaseous. Now, it has long been thought that this is a good explanation for galaxies. Now, it turns out that this is not necessarily the case. We now know that many galaxies form from smaller fragments. And it is easy to understand that if you have two individual clumps of stars that fall together, that once they merge, they would resemble more a system like this than they resemble a system like that. And this is almost certainly the case, right? Now, you may well think, why is it then that this would live for so long? But I had already indicated why that is, right? The question then before us is, can we still use the analysis of stellar orbits in terms of oscillators in these slightly more general systems? The answer is yes, we can, but then we have to first look at what the potential of this kind of system is like. That will take a few steps.